Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. These messages are intended to spark your own reflections and conversations all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime along with other resources and ways to keep the conversation going at fabricmpls.com/scraps.
So this is our second week talking about something that we're calling Not One Stone. And in case you weren't here for last week when we kicked it off, it's about a project that all of us have in our lives. And it's centered around this idea that as human beings, we have this tendency to take the living and petrify it. Have you noticed that? We take the stuff that is most meaningful to us, and then in order to organize, codify, and ritualize it, we go through that process so that then we can make sure it's manageable and we can preserve it and we understand it. In essence, we want to control those most meaningful things to us. And in the process, what happens with all of that is we take this precious thing to us that was living and breathing, and we turn it into the shell that was meant to only to hold it. And while that shell might be shiny, it might be impressive, it isn't living. And that's a problem. We replace this living thing with something that is not living. It's not what we started out with. So Not One Stone, what we're talking about here is how we do this with God, faith, and church. We've taken this spiritual experience, these insights, these stories, these inheritances that have been given to us, and we've turned them into religion. All right? So to catch up, this is on your papers too, what I mean by that is religion is our human attempt at capturing and preserving a spiritual experience. As such, there's nothing bad about religion, not necessarily, but it is never the real thing. All right? It's just our way of mocking it up, of controlling it, containing it, holding it, passing it on to other people. And and just like no temple can actually hold God, except perhaps the human heart, and that's a whole different conversation, right? Likewise, no set of doctrines or no code of behaviors, no denomination, no institution can hold what we experience when we weave our lives deeply with others and with God. And you'll notice that often when I'm talking about God, I do it with a little bit of hesitation or some qualifying words, because God, that word God is the same thing, right? I mean, the word God can never quite communicate what it is that we are trying to talk about when we refer to whatever it is that is beyond, above, and but nonetheless, we need to be able to refer to it, so we do that. And there's a danger in that when we become used to it and we aren't aware of it. So this title, Not One Stone, came from a time when Jesus was in the capital city of Judaism, which was Jerusalem. And he's walking around with his followers, and his followers are impressed by all the buildings, and one of them points out to Jesus, "Oh, wow, look at these large and beautiful buildings all around us." And Jesus' response to him is, "Yeah, see them? Not one stone will be left upon another. All will be thrown down. Not one stone will be left upon another. All will be thrown down." Now, just for the record, to be totally clear, he was not talking about building. I mean, here we are before the movement that Jesus was going to be the catalyst for, that would span the globe and include more people than any other movement we've ever known of. He was already saying, this thing that you're going to do to what I'm about, it's got to be torn down, until not one stone is left upon another, because that's what you do. And we need to work against that, all right? So this process of shedding the facade and preserving what matters is a task all of us have all the time, but as a society, we have deferred it so long in regard to God and faith and church, and when we're doing that, we've been imprisoning the real thing behind walls that are so tall and so thick that today, most people can't detect anything living inside of it anymore. That's a problem. You know, we need to find a way to get past that. It's a long time since we should have started this work. And I guess in many ways it has been going on in some circles, but we haven't accepted it as a church, as a religion, to realize that we need to tear this down until not one stone is left upon another and get back to the real thing. And we don't do this in order to rebuild the temple. We aren't doing it to create a new religion or to get all the things right, to get the right set of doctrines and things like that. No, that's the problem in the first place. We do it in order to be able to get back to that place where we can be in that real relationship, the authentic relationship with our true selves and with others and with God. And yes, we will always have trappings around it, but we don't make the mistake of thinking that those are the thing, but they simply help us to see the thing. They point at it. And we keep on doing it until there is nothing left between us and that which gives us meaning in our lives, not one stone. Anyway, so this week's title, If It Doesn't Make Sense, It Doesn't Make Sense. Now, that may not sound like a terribly insightful thing. That may not be a big insight, but it's pointing at a really big problem, and it's the really big reason of why we need to be talking about this and why, you know, we need to start over with God, faith, and church. For some reason, we expect stuff to make sense in the world. I mean, we do. I want my world to make sense, and when something doesn't make sense, we find a way to make sense of it. We figure it out. The way cars have developed, they're way too complicated for me to make sense of. But I know someone over on 36 and Lindell who can, and so I take my car there, and they make sense of it and fix it for me, okay? We do that until we get to this world of religion. Then all of a sudden, it's okay for things not to make sense anymore. People turn that all off, and we not only don't demand that this relationship with others and God and how we perceive the world doesn't make sense, but in some strange ways, in some strange cases, we actually insist that it shouldn't make sense. And that doesn't make sense. Yeah? For instance, let me give you one. God is assumed to be supernatural, right? God is miraculous. You know, God. And so when God acts in the world, it has to be interrupting what would have happened if God hadn't acted, right? It can't be natural. It has to be supernatural. It has to break the laws of physics. Otherwise, it wasn't God. It was just natural, and God wasn't present there. That gets a little bit strange. Now, there are some areas where we get a little fuzzy on all of this. These God interventions, like, a good example would be medical innovation. People often talk about those as modern-day miracles. They aren't real miracles, but they're so good, we want to give God some credit for it. So we kind of find some fuzzy way to do that, like penicillin, right? Like penicillin has saved so many million lives. We want to say this is one of God's miracles in the world, but we all know that Louis Pasteur made it. It didn't like just pop up in his lab and say, deliver to a hospital. You know, so then we start kind of fudging our rules a little bit. So, well, God inspired him, but he did kind of figure it out. I mean, even though it was just mold on a piece of bread, I mean, he did kind of use his scientific method to figure it out. But we kind of give it a slip, and, you know, it wasn't a miracle like in Bible days, but maybe it's the kind of miracle that we have today, and it all gets kind of fuzzy and mushy, and that's okay because it's God's stuff, and God's stuff doesn't have to make sense because it's God's stuff, and that's okay, we'll just go with it. Now, it seems innocent enough, right? That seems kind of like harmless enough. But there's problems there, because that kind of thinking ends up getting applied to our real lives and real situations and the way we actually interact with each other, and it actually starts making a difference. There's a problem with this. I could talk too long about this, Melanie. But let me just go into a couple of ways that I think you've run into these problems. Have you ever noticed that we give God credit for the good stuff that happens, but we tend to give God a pass when it isn't so good? You know, someone lives through a car accident, and the doctors say, I don't know how this person could possibly have lived. You know, it's a miracle. But then their uncle died unexpectedly, and there was, like, no reason to think that this was ever going to happen, and that was just unfortunate. Bad luck. Penicillin was God's gift to us through an inspired mind, but heat-seeking missiles? Yeah, we just don't go there. We don't think about those inspired minds. So that's a problem. Then there's another take on this. There's the pious, it was God's will. You know, that's a line we use to deal with unfortunate things that happen that we can't explain. We say it to imply that there is some sense to what happened, we just can't know it because it's God's way of understanding things and we don't know that. Because God is outside, different, got own set of logic and whatever. Unlike the giving credit to God for the good stuff, which ignores then the bad stuff, this says that all the bad stuff really is good stuff in disguise. It's easy for me to say from far away, this is, you know, that was God's will. But how do you say that to the person who's actually dealing with the pain, the suffering, the loss, maybe year after year after year? This is God's will. It's happened with entire populations, races, genders, social groups. Let me recap those two. It doesn't make sense, number one, to give God credit for the good stuff and give God a pass on the bad stuff. We run into problems when you start doing that. It doesn't make sense also to explain bad stuff as good stuff in disguise. Now, I may have just stepped on someone's toes here. I may have mentioned something that you've thought, said, believed. I have no interest, believe me, in knocking down your deeply felt ideas, because I know they probably come from experiences, from things that you have learned that are deeply important to you and you hold on to for some important reasons. I'm hoping you'll be able to see that we don't necessarily have to make those choices. There are other ways of understanding this that doesn't get rid of the wonder. It doesn't get rid of the mystery of God. So I want to just think about some of the impacts that this has on real lives. One, just think of the people who struggle their entire lives, never getting any break, waiting for God's blessing to come to them, when they see other people who just get it so easily over and over again and don't seem to either deserve it or appreciate it. Think of the parents grieving the death of their child and are told by a well-meaning church friend that God needed another angel. Or the man who destroyed his life and his family's life through his disease of alcoholism and is told by someone else that nothing happens without a reason. Consider the Crusades, the witch trials, slavery, keeping women subject to men, nullifying the lives and love of LGBTQ people, because those in power found it convenient, unconsciously or consciously, it sort of doesn't matter, they found it convenient to have God's unquestionable will not love that group of people. Think about the tens of millions of good, bright, eager, soul-searching folks who yearn to be part of something bigger than themselves in order to deal with the real stuff of life. I'm talking about your friends, your neighbors, maybe I'm talking about you, who does not see God, faith, and church, that whole world as an avenue to experience that because they see that world as a place that denies reality instead of digging in and dealing with it. So there's a fundamental question here. Are God and science two trains heading from the station in different directions, and you've got to decide which one you're going to be on, or is science part of our ever-growing, probably incompletable movement of understanding who, what God is, and how this world, how this universe, how this fabric of existence is woven together? What's the difference between those two? I think it's pretty big, and I think they present us with very different questions about life. Now, last week, I talked about the voice that might be in the back of your head. I don't know how you grew up, but you may have grown up with a very fundamentalist background or at least had that around you, and that voice is already talking to you and saying, well, the difference between those isn't a matter of our choice. One is faithful and one is faithless. One simply accepts God and lets God be God and does what the Bible says. The other one is human arrogance and human invention. And I know which one I'm tempted to believe, that's conformity, but I know the one that I'm called to believe. I think that's a pretty false choice. So here's a question that I think is much more helpful. So here, first of all, do you see God as being part of the world with us? Do you see God as being part of the world with us, with whom we can grow in participation? God is part of the world with us, with whom we can grow in participation. That's one choice. The other is, do you see God as being apart from the world, outside, separate from, different from, just creating, but then standing back and looking, being outside of it all, and then to whom we are now subject without understanding? We have no access because whatever reality we are in is different than God's reality. So we will never truly understand or know the mind of God. And therefore, we are instructed, we're informed of what God wants, and we are struggling to please. We are relying on other people who are in the know somehow to tell us what it is we're supposed to know. A part of or apart from? I've been reading the Bible for a very long time, very deeply. And while the Bible is a product of cultures and of minds that are thousands of years old, therefore it is unreasonable for us to expect the Bible to be speaking about math, science, physics, any of that kind of stuff, in the way that we would understand it today in our generation. Nonetheless, what I have found is that the Bible doesn't get irrational about these things. The writers portray a God that is part of, not apart from, the world and how it works. And while the span of culture and time makes it a little bit fuzzy sometimes, I think it also describes a world in which we participate with God, not where we are subject to, not where we are in just sheer obedience to God. Put it another way, because I told you so is not an accurate translation of thus says the Lord, all right? Thus says the Lord is God saying, you want to peek behind the curtains? This is how it all works. Okay, so there are times when I think this is glaringly clear. Psalm 50 is one of them. That's the weekly reading. If you do that, it's on the back of your Sunday papers. I just want to deal with a chunk of it here. I want to share this with you, as you know, hopefully with this frame that maybe I've created for you to be able to see this. I want to share this with you, and I just have to let you know that this is Greg's non-standard version of it. You know, take them home. It's on the back of your Sunday page. Take it home and compare it to your Bible and say, yeah, you know, actually, yeah. I think it's trying to say the same thing, all right? I'm just trying to put it in terms that make sense for us today. So let me walk you through this. The heavens declare God's alignment. Declare the heavens, right? I mean, we're not talking heaven, the heavens. That's the sky, stars, moon, right? Sun, that's the heavens, right? They declare, they show God's alignment. Now, the word there is the word for righteousness, God's righteousness. We talked about this last week. Righteousness is right relationship. That's what righteousness means, to be in right relationship. God's alignment with us, with the world, with all things. The heavens show us God's alignment. For God alone is the measure. The word there, mishpat, judge. But what does the judge do? The judge is the one who says, yes, this fits, it matches what should be or shouldn't be. God, which is all things, right? Is the only thing that can actually say what's in or what's out, what belongs, what doesn't. Then it goes on. Hear my people, God is speaking, and I will speak. Israel. Israel, again. What is Israel? The name of the people of God, which means those who wrestle with God. A literal translation of Israel, those who wrestle with God. Okay, I'm going to share something with you, those of you who are wrestling with God, wrestling with me. I will show you how you have this all wrong. What? All right, so this is a tough time in Israel's life. They're trying to move forward, and things aren't all going the way they want. So they're asking, like, what's happening? And God, I am who I am, Yahweh, says, I'm going to show you how you got this all wrong. This is just the greatest. He's, I am God, you're God. All right, got it, right? That's who I am. You're not doing the sacrifices wrong. That's what they were thinking, you know. Hey, we're doing something wrong at the temple, and so God's not happy with this, and everything's going bad. You're not. You don't have the sacrifices wrong, and this is just great. Your burnt offerings before me are nonstop, like enough already, okay? The truth is, I am not interested in a bull from your house or goats from your fold. Do you realize that every wild animal of the forest is mine? The cattle on 1,000 hills, mine? I know all the birds of the air, and all that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, this is the grace, if I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you, for the world and all that is in it is mine. And by the way, do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Come on, get real. You want to offer me a sacrifice? Try gratitude. I mean, that's what I want. I mean, that's what the sacrifices are about in the first time. You're acknowledging how you are connected to me. Commit to the ways of the one above all others. Recognize, admit the fact that it all fits together, and don't try to make it up for yourself. Be a part of what I have created and I am a part of with you. The Bible doesn't reduce the wonder and the mystery. It just says that, no, we're part of that wonder and that mystery, and that it does make sense. Sure, the Bible is full of a lot of wonder about the universe. You'll find this from Psalm 8. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have established, what are human beings that you're mindful of them, mortals that you care for them, standing in awe and wonder of the majesty of it all. And there's wonder about the breathtaking complexity of what it means for us to be human beings. Again, in the Psalms, for it was you who formed my innermost self, and you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am amazingly and wonderfully made. And then there's no lack of recognition that whatever God is up to is bigger than anything that we will ever figure out and ever be able to be in control of ourselves. Like this. This is Paul writing in the New Testament. I pray that you may have the power to comprehend. Just comprehend the breadth, the length, the depth of the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge. So with all of the wonder and the inability to grasp what those writers thousands of years ago saw, they still did not see God as something outside of the order of this world, but rather something that was greater than their ability to grasp it. That's an important difference. We begin to live differently into the world. We begin to think about this and try to be people of God, people with one another, people with our true selves differently when we see it that way. Take the last verse of that last, or the last few words of that last verse I shared. It says, the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge. It does not say the love of Christ that contradicts knowledge. But in the meantime, religion being religion has become irrational, not super rational. And it has become supernatural, not supernatural, which is, I think, what we're called. My proposal, you've heard me say this before, and I think it's a good guideline. You can do with it what you wish, but I would say that the ways of God are counterintuitive, which means I wouldn't have thought of that. Why? Because it's calling me to a deeper place. On my surface way of living on the fabric of existence, I'm pretty superficial, and I, you know, pay more attention to my wants, to my desires, to my preferences, than to what I really kind of discover what's true about the world, all right? So the ways of God tend to be counterintuitive, but they make sense. They make sense. When I really dive into it, when I really reconcile with it, when I sit with it, I start seeing a world that says, yeah, that actually is how things work. That is how I find fulfillment in myself. That generosity actually is better than miserliness. Giving is better than getting. These kinds of things, they tend to make sense for us, and experience through life confirms them for us. So there is this notion that, I don't know if anybody ever says it to you, but a lot of traditional religion tends to imply it. And this idea is that you were given a brain by God as a temptation to use it. You know? Like, if you think too hard, if you use what God gave you, you're going to get in trouble with God. So I'm going to give you a brain with an amazing ability to think and to wonder, and if you do it, you are faithless. That makes sense? I don't think that makes sense in a world where people are dedicating lifetimes to learning in order to create a medical advance that could save millions of lives, and they see that as the love of God becoming real in the world. I don't think that makes sense for people who spent their lives and their effort and their hard work and pour their hearts into understanding issues or understanding people so that they can help and so that they can support and so that they can be with those people. And assuming that that wisdom that they are gaining is not incongruent with what God is trying to show them about the world. It's actually one and the same, and simply approaching where God is trying to take us and what God is trying to give us. It all comes down to connection. It's the last thing there. It all comes down to connection. Are all things connected? Are we part of? Or are we apart from? Do we live in a world in which things make sense and they fit together? Except for when God gets involved, and then we don't know. We don't know. We could be any kind of curveball will come in at that point. Let me give you a picture of that. This next slide here, this is a bunch of numbers written on a page. Fairly uninteresting, fairly boring. What they are is just examples of when you take a number and you add it to all the numbers that came before it, you keep adding that up, and then what you get. Then you take that number and add it to the next one and the next one and the next one, and it just keeps getting to be a bigger. I mean, like, who cares, right? It just ends up being a series of numbers. You could call it a sequence. In fact, this is a sequence that's got thousands of years of history. It's called the Fibonacci sequence. You say, well, like, so? I mean, yeah, bunch of numbers on page. Well, the thing is, if you take those numbers and you take each number and you turn it into a space of this, that size, and you start stacking them up, you get something that looks like this, which maybe you've seen. It's kind of interesting. Which isn't just a graphic representation, but it tends to be found in nature all over the place. Like this nautilus shell. You know, it isn't like the nautilus is trying to show off, or God is trying to show off some interesting, obscure, kind of elegant and simple mathematical formula to awe us, but it works, right? I mean, there's a reason why the nautilus shell is built that way, and not just the nautilus shell, but yeah, this, a succulent doing the exact same thing. In fact, nature has found that this isn't just like something we're supposed to do, right? This makes sense. It's kind of like how the world works. And so lots of things actually use it. Ferns, pineapples, pine cones, galaxies. The whorl on your thumbprint is a product of the Fibonacci sequence. Now, what does it prove? I mean, it doesn't prove anything. It makes sense. It's how structures work. It's how they happen. At least it's one way that they happen. And extends way beyond these patterns of plants or fingerprints or galaxies. It extends into what it means to be human. Not the Fibonacci sequence. That is simply an example of how we see what makes sense playing itself out in nature. We make sense too. The ways of God are not foreign and separate and different from us, but are embedded in who we truly are. And as we discover ourselves, we discover God. As we discover others, we discover God. As we discover God, we discover ourselves, we discover others. Let me end with these words of Jesus. Chances are you've never heard them this way before. Comes from Matthew's gospel. I want to first just read it to you. Jesus said, "Come to me, all you that are weary and are carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light." Put on the lens of God that is of and part of all things and calls us to participate rather than be a part of and figure out our own world, try to create our own world, which we never can do. And think about those words again. "Come to me, all you who are weary and carrying heavy burdens." Is that talking to those of us trying to make our own world, who are trying to live against the grain? We don't understand who we are, how beauty and wonder and love and generosity and goodness, and yeah, even the cold, hard facts of science and mathematics are woven into the fabric of this world. Instead, we live lives pushing uphill the whole way. And Jesus' yoke, the one he was living with, that he is inviting us to carry, yeah, it's a burden too. It's real. We must carry it, but it makes sense. It is part of, not apart from this world. It invites us in rather than keeping us out. It isn't coercing or it isn't demanding anything of us. It is gentle and humble of heart. And when we are in sync with it, when we live with it, we find rest for our true selves, for our souls. It isn't because it's so easy or it is never has any failure, no. It's inviting us into a world that is big enough for the good and for the bad. We don't have to try to come up with some strange excuse for each of them. It invites us into a world that is big enough for success and for failure. It even invites us into a world that is big enough for life and for death. You make sense. You do. I do too. Our world makes sense. We don't always like the sense that we see. We sometimes don't understand it all. We haven't figured that out. We probably never will, but it does. I invite you to help us create a community that makes sense, that helps us live with what we are being called to, not impose something about what we have to experience every day of our lives. We live in a world where we are called to behave in certain ways that are very arbitrary to what and who we truly are. We are called to accept values that actually do not represent what is most important to most of us. And together, I think we can create a world where it doesn't have to be that way, where we can pull these pieces together and let them be connected.
Thanks for listening. We hope you take this conversation and keep it going. If we are adding value to your life, we appreciate your support of this work so we can engage more people in these conversations that matter for their real lives too. You can do that at fabricmpls.com/give. We'd also love to have you join us any Sunday morning at 10:30 at Field Community School in Minneapolis. That's at 4645 4th Avenue South. There are opportunities for kids of all ages to connect too. Learn more by searching Fabric Minneapolis.